Okay, very important legends and lessons tonight. We were speaking about Rav Shamshin Rifolhirsch. Now the truth is that some people, first of all, call him Rav Shimshon Rifolhirsch. Mm-hmm. Apparently his name was Rav Shamshin.
No.
I'm not really sure where the name Shamshin comes from. I assume it's some kind of German pronunciation or Yiddish pronunciation of the word Shimshon. But either way, he went by Shamshin. What's also interesting is he did not go by Shamshin Rifal. What was Rafal? Rafal was his father's name.
Yes, it was Ben.
In Germany, the custom was that you would take on your father's name, apparently, as a middle name. I don't know why. I don't know the origins of it, but that's apparently what happened. I don't know too much about those cultural differences, but I think that it's also very interesting. First of all, today's December 31st?
30th.
Okay, so tomorrow is actually the English date that he died. His yahrzeit's at the end of the Hebrew month, Teves, but his English date of death is actually tomorrow, which is very interesting. 1888, so I guess we're going on 131 years. 131 years ago, yes, tomorrow, in the English calendar. But what's also interesting is, as you can tell from his dates, 1808 to 1888, he lived a nice long time for the 19th century, I guess. But also remember, he wasn't... he lived in sort of prosperous, medically advanced communities. He wasn't like in the shtetl or anything like that, which is also very important because on Wednesday, last Wednesday and this coming Wednesday, as we've been publicizing, we're giving these early American tshuvas classes, right? Last week we gave tshuvas from Rabbi, really a rabbi from across town from where he grew up in Altona, Rabbi Etlinger. Rav Yaakov Etlinger, who was his own Rebbe. So he refers to his Rebbe. And then this coming Wednesday, we're giving a tshuva from Rabbi Bernard Eloi. Rabbi Bernard Eloi actually spoke to Rav Hirsch. He was like his liaison to America, right? He basically communicated with Rav Hirsch on a number of issues, including the one that we're, well, not exactly the one that we're talking about, but whenever Rav Hirsch wanted to know something about America, he would always reach out to Rabbi Eloi, and there's some correspondence in some European publications between the two of them. But what's interesting is that one of Rabbi Eloi's tshuvas that we're going to read on Wednesday, hopefully, it says in there that he passed it by Rav Hirsch, right? Before he published, he passed it by him and got his approval, sort of like his haskama. So you'll see a lot of English on the paper here. This is actually from something called the 19 letters, which we'll get to. But first, let's go through... Oh, here. Yeah. First, let's go through a little bit of Rav Hirsch's life. So, Rav Hirsch, born in 1808 in Hamburg, which at the time was not part of Germany. It was actually in France. And I assume that's where the hat comes from, but I couldn't tell you. So he studies with his father. His father was actually a pro bono assistant rabbi in a neighboring town called Altoona, which is where Rabbi Yaakov Etlinger was also, which you mentioned last week. But he wasn't a rabbi by trade. He didn't get paid to be a rabbi. He got paid to be a salesman. He was a merchant. And he and his wife were hoping that young Samson would also be a merchant. And much to their chagrin, as is the minhag of many Orthodox Jewish mothers, Rabbi Samson disagreed and became a rabbi. And obviously, we're all thankful for that. But I do want to have a basic disclaimer. And I'll start like this. A few years ago, I was in Denver to visit my brother. And my brother does things with, and he runs NCSY in Denver. So when he ran NCSY in Denver, so he has, he still runs NCSY in Denver, he has these lattes and learn. That's what they call it, latte and learns. And he, all the NCSYers come, you know, all the people, they come to Starbucks or whatever it is, and the NCSY sponsors their crazy drinks that they can concoct for the most expensive possible drink. And then they schmooze and they have fun, and then they talk Torah, they divert Torah, whatever. So my brother, when I was there, invited me to lead the group. So he always starts with some kind of icebreaker. So the icebreaker that night was, if you had to choose one Jewish figure in history to have dinner with, who would it be? And everyone's giving all their answers, Moshe Rabbeinu and Rashi and Tosafot, you know, all these different answers. And I said Rav Hirsch. I said Rav Hirsch because in many ways Rav Hirsch is the predecessor for the lifestyle that we're all trying to lead, which is a fusion between a steadfast commitment to Orthodox practice while also embracing the modern culture around us to the extent that we're able to and to the extent that it's kosher, etc. And the truth is that there's much debate as to what American Orthodoxy is relative to Rav Hirsch's theology, because, or philosophy, I should say, because Rav Hirsch's theology or philosophy didn't really come over from Europe, at least in the way that other philosophies came over from Europe. Hasidism came straight from Europe to America. Rav Hirsch died in 1888, but you don't find a lot of Rav Hirsch theology and philosophy coming over into Rabbinic Judaism during his lifetime, even though there were rabbis like Rabbi Eloi. You don't find it really at the turn of the century. You really only find it taking root in the early, well, not even the early, more the mid-20th century. Around the Second World War is when Rav Hirsch's theology really becomes a prominent, you know, philosophy in America. When they establish the school in Washington Heights, Rav Boyer comes over to Washington Heights. That's really when his philosophy comes over to America. And yet, everyone sees Rav Hirsch as sort of like the father of what some called neo-Orthodoxy, modern Orthodoxy, this engagement with culture, despite also being committed to religious practice. So despite the fact that we sort of tailor our philosophy in many ways to what Rav Hirsch talks about, in other ways, it's not necessarily a clean, you know, transition from his books into American theology, because it didn't happen that way. So it's always a word of caution for that. He doesn't explicitly say, do this, do that. He talks about ideas, he talks about beliefs, but it's hard to make an actual claim. Either way. Yes, we'll get there, yeah. That's what he called it. So his grandfather was also a well-known Rav. His great-uncle was a writer of Sfarim. His father wanted him to be a merchant, but he chose to go into Ravanas. But when he was a kid, he actually went to public school. He did not go to Cheder in any other... I got one more, Ron. Sorry, no. So he gets an early education from his father, who was also a learned man. He was an assistant Rav. It wasn't like he was a nobody, but he still didn't want him to be a rabbi. I guess he had intimate contact with what it means to be a rabbi, and he said you shouldn't do it. But either way, he disregards that advice. He goes to study with the Rav Akiva Ettinger, also known as the Aruch Lener, a very famous parish on Gemara. And by the time he's 22, he says it's time to go to college. So he goes to the University of Bonn, B-O-N-N. I don't know much about it, but it was university nonetheless. He studies language, philosophy, history, but he actually never graduated with a degree, interestingly enough. He just never finished and got a degree, but he was definitely there. Soon after, he becomes the chief rabbi of a very small town, but he was a chief rabbi. In Kansas City, there was a rabbi there, Rabbi Ellis, or at least his parents lived there, and he would come once a year. He was the chief rabbi of Warsaw. I said, how many Jews are you the rabbi of? He's the chief rabbi? Or maybe he was the chief rabbi of Poland, which is basically Warsaw and Krakow. But there are Jews. They're just scattered around. So they say, I heard from Dr. Henry Abramson, who's a big bucky in Jewish history. So he said that in his town of Oldenburg, there were 40 families. He's a chief rabbi of Oldenburg, 40 families. And scattered around the neighboring communities was maybe another few Jews, but overall it wasn't like there was this big job, but he was the chief rabbi. And while he's there, because there's not so many people, he actually takes up writing. And thank God for that, because many of his most influential writings, at least, you know, when he's at his peak, I don't want to say polemicist mode, but more in terms of like his spilling out of his worldview, comes at this time in his 20s, early, you know, obviously younger than I am, now that I can say that. But in his 20s, he writes first a collection of letters which he publishes anonymously. He doesn't put his name on, or I should say pseudonymously, if that's the word. He basically, and we're going to read from it later on, but he basically makes up a conversation between a Jew who's been convinced and swayed by secularism around him and this rabbi named Ben Uziel. Both of them are him. But he's picturing, he's imagining, he's creating this dialogue between a secularized Jew who used to be Orthodox, what we would call maybe off the derech, but in ideological terms, not in, you know, behavioral terms, and this, you know, Orthodox rabbi. And they go back and forth, and there are 19 letters, called 19 letters. We have a copy in our base medrash, which is now inaccessible, so sorry, I could not get it for you. But it is a fascinating read. I remember skimming it when I was younger. I probably should know it better if I am going to be such a Talmud of Refresh. Yeah.
Did he pick any Ben Uziel on purpose?
I have no idea where it comes from. I actually don't know. We have Yonatan Ben Uziel, which is a commentary on the Chumash. And Refresh, as we know, was an astute student of, you know, commentaries on Chumash. But I do not know why he picked that. Maybe it's in the introduction to the book.
Or something. Like the Kuzari?
It's interesting. The Kuzari was also a fictional story by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, and in many ways, I guess it does follow that structure. Obviously, it's a different situation because the Kuzari was a king, and he was looking to convert to Judaism. I think they say it might have been loosely based on a real story. He's looking to convert to anything, you know. Rabbi, preacher, whatever. I don't know the other people he spoke to. So he was obviously the bulk of the book is the Jew, but that was a king looking to join a religion. This is a secular Jew looking to not be part of religion that Refresh is trying to talk to him. But it's interesting. We'll see soon how that book starts. So here are the 19 letters. He also writes a book called Chorev. People know Chorev. They've seen that book. Chorev. Presumably based on Har Sinai. Har Chorev. But what is Chorev about? Chorev is all about the mitzvos. And Dr. Henry Abramson explained that he actually thought this was one of the most fundamental books of Rav Hirsch. And Rav Hirsch wrote a lot. He wrote a lot of works. But Chorev, which he writes also when he's 28 years old, is basically a breakdown of every mitzvah in the Torah and why we do that. Which is not only an undertaking in terms of the depth and breadth of knowledge you have to talk about it, but also in terms of the theological riskiness of it, right? You know, when the Rambam says we don't know why we do mitzvos, so like that's not because we just never sat down to figure it out. That's because we're not supposed to know the reasons why. So when the Sefer HaChinuch also writes his, whoever that was, when the Sefer HaChinuch writes his, you know, book explaining all the reasons for the mitzvos, he says, you know, very explicitly, we don't really know the reasons. So Rav Hirsch does the same thing. We don't know the reasons, but this could be a possible reason. And as opposed to all the other rabbis of the time who sort of just hoped that the people would stay in the fold and continue doing all the halacha with no, you know, philosophical underpinnings, Rav Hirsch said, these people are not, you know, foolish. He says this in the 19 letters also. People aren't foolish. These young people are looking intellectually at why they should be convinced of Judaism. And he writes this book, Chorev, in order to try to convince and persuade people as to the philosophy of Judaism, the philosophy of mitzvos, not just to think of it as some kind of dry, ancient, historical movement, but as something that we should think about, believe in, that there's purpose to the mitzvos, etc. So this is what Chorev is about. He actually published that when he was 30. I'm sorry, so I still have time. During the time of his popular, the reason that he writes these books, as you can imagine, is really a response to what has developed through the Enlightenment, right? The Haskalah, which was really started in France by the French Revolution in the 18th century or the end of the 18th century. It might have had, you know, it might have had influences from before, but that's basically when it starts, and throughout the. Throughout the 19th century, it basically develops in different countries in different ways. In Germany, it was a little different. because Germany wasn't a monolith, right? It wasn't like France. Like, France was all ruled by the same power. Germany had these different little colonies, and it was constantly reforming based on who was in power. So it didn't have the same kind of sweeping influence like it did otherwise. But around the time of Rav Hirsch, so the Jews basically were gaining what's called gaining ground in the emancipation movement. The emancipation movement basically was in order to gain, for lack of a better term, citizenship for Jewry. There wasn't such thing really in Germany at the time. But basically it means making the Jews a full-fledged citizen of that society, of that culture. Whereas opposed, they were always on a lower level. Maybe they had restrictions in terms of positions of power. They had restrictions in terms of economic priority or positions that they could hold. And depending throughout history, they were always subject to the whims of any ruler of that time. They literally could be used as a pawn in different decisions by any government. So at the time, the Jews were picking up ground in the emancipation movement, and part of, at least in Germany, part of the strategy for many Jews using the concept of enlightenment was in order was to show the German, the German officials or the German society that they can be Germans too. Right? So much of that comes down to the dilution of Jewish practice. Right? When we go to our sanctuaries, we can also speak German. And when we go to our sanctuaries, we can also play the organ. And when we go to our sanctuaries, we can also just listen to the clergy. And in some instances, apparently, according to Dr. Abramson, we can also only worship on Sunday. Right? We can be just like you. Right, and this was part of the strategy of convincing the German culture that they can be upstanding German citizens.
And now, the reform movement.
Yes, so the reform movement, which doesn't really have ideological leaders, but ideological influencers. Abraham Geiger, for instance, was a major thinker in the reform movement, and this was basically their concept. That their theme was bringing Judaism into the 19th century meant doing away with outdated and antiquated things that they didn't feel comfortable with their neighbors who weren't doing those types of things. So one of the major things that they did was also do away with the concept of messianic times, right? When they were trying to show people that they thought Germany was their place and that they could be upstanding German citizens, that means we don't hope to go anywhere else. We hope to stay here. We hope to establish ourselves here. This is the end of our line. This is where we want to be. So that means we don't believe in Mashiach anymore. We don't believe in settling the land of Israel anymore. That also means that we're not going to call our sanctuaries, we're not going to call them synagogues. They're not just places of worship. They're now temples. This is the end all be all. This is our temple. We don't want to go anywhere else. And you can go to Europe and you can see these buildings that have etched into their walls. I remember seeing one in Poland where they call themselves a temple. This is, I remember one in Krakow or something, somewhere like that, one of the bigger cities. It said something like, Shovavet Zion or something like that, like the settlers of Zion. Like, this is our Zion, right? That this is where we want to be. We don't want to go anywhere else. And obviously, there are counter movements to that radicalism. They're not only counter movements to create what we now call orthodoxy, because that always existed, but also what they called then, what was it called? Historical Judaism. There's a term for the early conservative Judaism was called. No, and people don't know this. It was called something, historical Judaism or something like that. I don't remember. Zacharia Frankel, is that who started it? Either way, so these were all movements that were going on around Rav Hirsch. And his position was, we can either basically say, we're not budging, we're going to do everything like we've always done, or we can say, there's a place for Judaism in this century too. Even with all the modern acculturation, even with all the modern technology, Judaism still has something to say for our culture. And that's what he basically creates when he says he wants to create Torah im Derech Eretz, which is a borrowed term from Pirkei Avos, which, at least in Pirkei Avos, is referring to get a job, right? You know, Torah im Derech Eretz, you'll save yourself from sin. The point, at least in the literal sense in that Mishnah in Avos, is basically to say that you'll have money so you don't have to steal from anybody else. But he used it. It's a similar phrase, but Derech Eretz Kadmah LaTorah is really specifically about treating other people nicely. Torah im Derech Eretz is basically the way that Rav Hirsch understood it, the way that Rav Hirsch used it, I should say, not the way he understood it. Obviously, he has a parish on Avos, you would understand it otherwise. But he uses the term in order to dictate to people that we can be like the Eretz, we can engage in the society around us, but also keep the Torah. Torah im Derech Eretz. That the two things don't have to be mutually exclusive. We don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? If we're going to start saying sermons in German, that doesn't mean that we also have to start eating German cheeseburgers. We can just stick to the German, right? Stay there and don't go to the next step. So this is in many ways Rav Hirsch's big push for the rest of his life is in order to convince people you don't have to take that next step and throw everything out. You can hold that dissonance of being part of the society, but also being fervent and devoted Jews. When he was 38, he became the rabbi of Moravia, which was in Emden, also outskirts of Germany.
Jacob Emden?
It might be related. I mean, that's considered his last name, but he could be from there. That's why. And in Moravia, he felt he had a lot of pressure. A lot of pressure from the Enlightenment folk, the Reform Jews of the town, of the towns around there. He was so busy taking care of his own considerations in the community that he actually didn't write anything in these periods, or not a lot at least. These are times where he was willing to make concessions on a cultural level, even within a religious context. So, for instance, apparently he wore a clerical robe when he was in Moravia. He allowed to have an all-male choir. He allowed people to shave, and he allowed he gave his sermons in German.
This is Rav Hirsch.
This is a Rav Hirsch himself. Gave sermons in German, like I give sermons in English. You know, it was the same type of thing, although in those days it was much more controversial. The Chassam Sofer would not necessarily agree, although the Chassam Sofer had notable students that did do such a thing. He himself, and I think he even, if I remember correctly, corresponded with those students and allowed them to do it. But on the whole, the Chassam Sofer's stance was what? His famous line, as he writes in a tshuva, but became sort of a rallying cry for all Haredi Jews. Chadash Aser Min HaTorah. Chadash Aser Min HaTorah. Anything new, which is a reference to a very technical halacha about when you can eat the new wheat after Pesach, etc. But his stance was Chadash in general. No new innovations. We don't change what we do. By the way, this coming Wednesday, when we speak about Rabbi Bernard Elohi, Rabbi Bernard Elohi was the only student of the Chassam Sofer who got a PhD. Probably because of the Chassam Sofer, he's the only one, because all his other students weren't willing to make that step. But he ends up coming to America, the only student of the Chassam Sofer directly that came to America. And in all of his correspondence with European rabbis, he never reached out to the Chassam Sofer. So there might have been some distance between them, despite the fact that he learned by him. But either way, that's the Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer was on, holding the line on the other side, right? He was holding the line, whereas Rav Hirsch was willing to, concede on some issues that were more cultural and less religious. Obviously, he keeps for a strong halacha. His sermons are all about halacha. Yes. There was a whole movement, if you remember this phrase from your early history classes, of you're a Jew in the home and you're non-Jew out of the home, right? So Rav Hirsch says, no such thing, right? You're a Jew everywhere, right? Which is not something you necessarily have to say once you say you're keeping halacha, but that was sort of his response. He didn't like the analysis of Gemara, or the Pilpul, the deep analysis. He was much more of a fan in analytics of texts of Tanakh, which is why he has commentaries on those. He doesn't have much commentary on Gemara, although he's clearly well-versed in Gemara. If anyone just reads some of his commentaries on the Chumash, you'll find that he references Gemara all the time. I once heard from a Rav in Baltimore that Rav Hirsch's parish on Chumash, the point of it was to show people the fusion of Torah Sheva'al Peh and Torah Sheva'al Chasav. I never got that impression from the commentary, but I'm not as much of an expert than that rabbi, so it's possible. But what you can see clearly from Rav Hirsch's commentary on the Torah is his commentary based on tradition. He's not just making things up, but it's a commentary based on the Gemara, based on Chazal, that every pasuk is trying to weave in that kind of thing. Finally, when he's 43, in 1851, he actually takes his last post of his life. And where? Where does he become the Rav?
Frankfurt.
Frankfurt on Main, right? Frankfurt on the Main River, which is sort of the flagship Yeki, you know, town. I remember when I was in Riverdale, for anyone who doesn't know it, is basically, you know, was a town developed by German Jews. And our shul, the Riverdale Jewish Center, basically all of its menhagim come from Germany. And now they've been diluted into an American context, but there are many leftover things. So whenever we would ask, you know, in the shul, like, what's the meaning of the shul? The answer is, oh, what did they do in Frankfurt? You know, what did they used to do when, you know, this situation in Frankfurt? And we had certain members of the community that were always very, you know, ardent followers of the Yekim and Hagim. Even if the shul wasn't doing it, they would do it. I remember one particular guy, he had special tunes for everything. Like, I don't know if anyone's familiar with the Yeki shul here, but there is a special tune. This is just indicative of the type of thing we're talking about. There's a special tune, first of all, for the repetition of Shmoneh Esrei in general, but when it's a day where you don't say Tachanun, there's a different nuance of a tune when you say Sim Shalom. Like when he said that tune, he knew it was a day with no Tachanun, he would say Sim Shalom differently. Like, that's the kind of thing we're talking about. Like, you know, minhagim that weren't necessarily halachic, but just sort of like the development of the minhag.
Different kaddish for every holiday.
Yeah, they had kaddishim, and obviously the
krovitz is... There was what they call the yaris kaddish, where they put them all in one at a time. I'm trying to get that on tape.
Yeah, I'm sure there are plenty of people you can find it. But yeah, so it's a fascinating culture, the fact that they've continued this. But Rav Hirsch was the Rav in Frankfurt on Main for 36 years, 37 years.
You know what they call it?
Not 30, 35 years. What do they call
it?
I like it. Okay.
What's that thing about being on time? You have to do things.
I don't know where that comes from. That's a family thing.
It's probably a German cultural thing.
The Japanese. It's a Yeki thing, but I don't know. I don't know if necessarily Torah and Derech Eretz has anything to do with that, except for the fact that they were refined people.
No, Rita Tal, husband tells his wife, I'm going to
seconds
late.
It's a German thing.
Yeah, it could be a German thing. I don't know. Either way, when he comes to Frankfurt, it was largely a reform city. Like, whenever you think of these big, bustling European cities, they're almost always very academic, very learned, but therefore also very secular, right? The fact that they're interested and engaged with all these academic pursuits means they're also less interested and less invested in Jewish pursuits. And therefore, he comes to Frankfurt, and it's a very reformed place. And soon after, after a few years, apparently his shul grew to over 500 families.
Wow.
500 families, that's what they say in Frankfurt. Mirza Shembayas. But we'll leave that to Milt.
Does it mean you're going to be here 36 years?
Right. It didn't take him 36 years. Yeah, right, that's the key. Just give it in German. He used to say, better not to be emancipated than to be assimilated. Right? That's a classic debate. The Lubavitcher Rebbe was famous for saying such a thing also. But he was actually opposed to the Zionist movement of Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, because he didn't think it would be man-made, which is actually interesting because most modern Orthodox in America don't see eye to eye with Rav Hirsch on that. He did love Eretz Yisrael, obviously, but not in the way that the early Zionist movement did, which had already existed in the end of the 1800s. That's, you know, in general, it's a... in general, that's sort of the life of Rav Hirsch, you know, certainly ideologically, but one story that sort of encapsulates it that people love to quote is the story where, first of all, Rav Hirsch was not very well at the end of his life. He had malaria from an early age, and he would always go through these different bouts of the sickness, and because of that, he would always be traveling. I read somewhere from a reputable source that he would go on the advice of his physicians, that he would go to the Baltic Sea, and that would have some kind of positive effect because of his malaria. I have no idea what that means, but he was therefore always traveling, and he does have considerable correspondence with people from around Europe, you know, big rabbis. Unfortunately, obviously, as we know, about 50 years after he dies, you know, Nazis take over and basically, you know, destroy the legacy of Frankfurt am Main and destroy the prosperity of Rav Hirsch's Torah im Derech Eretz, which would presumably and inevitably have spread throughout Europe and would have spread to now America, etc., but was cut short, certainly shorter than it should have been. But there was something very important that happened, and I don't remember the date or anything like that, but once he's in Frankfurt... So as I said, there was a very considerable Reform population there. And while in Frankfurt, and while dealing with all of these controversies with everybody around him that didn't like Orthodox Judaism, he actually created a new community, which apparently was not an easy thing to do. Because remember, at those times, it wasn't like nowadays where we basically just go wherever we want in America and we create communities without anyone's permission. Back then, every city got one Jewish community, right? Every city had their own little enclave where the Jews could live, or own little, you know, a community where the Jews were subject to. And then they could live freely within that place. And you had to get permission from the government, and they say that Rav Hirsch, all the rabbis in Germany at the time were paid by the government. They were clergy based on, you know, like nowadays we're a 501c3 and I can get, what's it called, my taxes?
Clergy.
What's it called?
Exemption.
What's the exemption called? Parsonage, right? Parsonage. So back then it wasn't just parsonage. It wasn't just like you don't have to pay taxes to a certain extent. You literally were paid by the government. Rav Hirsch's salary came from the Prussian government, apparently.
Really?
So when we think about that, the fact that Rav Hirsch goes to them and says, hey, can I have a different community, but I want to stay here, was a big undertaking. It was very controversial, too. There were other rabbis that disagreed with his approach, because on the one hand, he's saying to everybody, we have to engage with the general culture, and on the other hand, he's saying, I can't be around these Jews. We have to make some kind of statement. We have to say enough is enough. We have to sort of not isolate, but incubate our movement so that it's not affected by all these people that are trying to secularize everything we do. Because we are trying to hold the line. We're trying to engage with the culture, but also stay true to Torah orthodoxy. So he creates a new community called, I forgot what it's called, Astrite, something like that, where he creates basically a different community where it's separate and distinct from the other Frankfurt community of the Reform Jews. But that's basically, at least in the presentation of Dr. Abramson, is a legacy that we are all still dealing with in America, which is, on the one hand, we have to create our, you know, communities that embrace the culture, that embrace society, that are trying to help everyone, that we're not closed off from anybody, we're not isolating ourselves. But on the other hand, we also have to protect ourselves. That the dissonance that's created through engaging with community, engaging with culture, but devoting ourselves to Judaism, that dissonance is very susceptible to peeling people away from Torah. Right? It's a lot easier to engage fully with the secular society than it is to engage with both secular society and Jewish culture. So that's a dissonance or a balance that we're still dealing with today. And Rav Hirsch's response was, when push comes to shove, you got to protect the Torah. Right? When push comes to shove, that's where your priorities have to lie. That's where your allegiances have to stay. Torah im derech eretz, but if it comes at a cost, we know which one to cut off. And it's a balance that every Jewish community deals with, and it's a balance that every individual within every Jewish community has to deal with. I have friends, and I remember talking to them about what colleges to go to, etc. And every single person has to deal with it differently. And some people say, and this is not my own opinion, a lot of people say this, is Yeshiva University the best place to go for every single person? You know, it's Jewish, and it also gives you a college education, etc. It's just, the answer is obviously not. There are some people, when they go to Yeshiva University, will be swayed by the fact that there are academics under Jewish auspices that will lead them astray. There are philosophy classes at Yeshiva University. And you might think that because it's at Yeshiva University, then everything's great. And I don't have to put a filter on anymore because I'm under the YU banner. But the truth is, it would be better if you went to some secular college and then you would assume the opposite, that everything's no good. Right? But now that you're at YU and you're given both of these poles while under the same rubric, you think that it's okay to veer more to one side. So it doesn't matter what the balance is for the community. Every individual has to find it themselves. But one story that I mentioned earlier that I think encapsulates Rav Hirsch's view on the world is really based on Yerushalmi. But he said, after once going to a vacation in Switzerland, they asked, I don't know if this is a literal story, but apparently the line is true. They asked him, Rabbi, how could you go to Switzerland? The students in the Beis Medrash, the student, you should be learning, whatever. So he says, when I go to Shemayim after 120, Hashem is going to ask me, Rav Hirsch, what do you think about my Alps? I'm going to say that. What do you mean Alps? I had to sit in the Beis Medrash and learn. He said, I put Alps in the world for people to enjoy. And you just ignored them. So obviously there's a limit to that argument. But it still paints a picture of who Rav Hirsch was in terms of engaging with the world, not being blind to the things around him, not being blind to the enjoyments of the world that God created. But obviously there's a balance. And there's a toll to be taken if you take that overboard. Obviously you can take it overboard. But just as a quick portrait of this first... this conversation he imagines and he depicts while he's a lonely Rav. They say he was very lonely when he was in Oldenburg by himself with those 40 families. He could get very lonely. So he said he had no rabbi, so he made this book where he talked to himself. but this is the first letter. And remember, it sounds like a secular Jew, but it's really Rav Hirsch depicting a secular Jew. Right, so this is a first attempt to speak to the Jews that are being affected by secularism. And he says, when recently on occasion of your trip through the town of my residence, we were privileged to meet again after many years of separation for a short meeting hour, you did not imagine, my dear Naftali, Ben Uziel, his pseudonym, what interest the subject of our conversation had, and indeed still has for me. You found me so changed in my religious views and practices that, meaning he used to be Jewish and now he's no longer, doesn't at least Orthodox, he doesn't depict himself that way. Despite your habitual tolerance, you could not suppress the questions which rose, as it were, spontaneous to your lips. Since when and why? As answer, I gave you a whole series of accusations against Judaism concerning which my eyes had been opened by reading and contact with the world since I had left home and parents. So Rav Hirsch is painting this picture not only of the irreligious Jew, but also of the religious Jew that's looking at the irreligious Jew, right? The religious Jew that's looking and saying, why are they doing all those things? I mean, what's the proper response when we see a Jew like that? Should our response be, hey, let me go look at those things, or should my response be, Why would they want to do something like that? So this is also Rav Hirsch's, it's also within Rav Hirsch's presentation. You listened quietly to my speech, and when I had done, replied, do you believe that you really understand the object which you are thus condemning? Have you acquired with your own eyes and by dint of honest, earnest investigation an actual understanding of a matter which, inasmuch as it is the holiest and most important consideration of our life, should at least not be cast aside thoughtlessly and unreflectingly? What's he saying, basically? You think you have such a good chap against Judaism. Do you really know Judaism that well to make an argument against it? Right? I remember, I don't know if it was a rabbi or a mentor at one point who was teaching us how to, you know, how he deals with like NCS wires or Kiruv and things like that. And when he would get a question from one of these people that are trying to upschlag Judaism, say, why does it do this? You know, he would say, oh, you know, no one ever thought of that. You're right. And he would just take his yarmulke off. And he'd say, you're right. No one ever thought of that. Like, do you think you're so intelligent and you're so, you know, brilliant beyond your years that you thought of something no one ever thought of? That the Jewish people have no response to? And therefore you conclude that you must be smarter and you must be able to dissuade anyone from this belief? Obviously not. So this is what Rav Hirsch is saying. He's saying, is it really so that you understand so much that you can condemn it? You showed me, this is the irreligious Jew speaking, you showed me that the only sources of my knowledge were, on the one hand, the mechanical practice of parental customs, and a few imperfect and undigested fragments of the Bible and Talmud acquired from Polish speakers. Right? So on the one hand, what do I know about Judaism? I just saw my dad put on tefillin, and I heard my cheder teacher say something about Rashi. Right? And on the other hand, Christian writers, modern reformers, and especially that view of life which our present age has brought forth, and which has, at its chief endeavor, the suppression of the inner voice of conscience in the favor of the external demands of comfort and ease. So basically he's saying, who's determining your decision? On the one hand, you've got all the things you know nothing about but you saw your parents do. And on the other hand, you got comfort and luxury that everybody around you was doing. So obviously, if you have a superficial view of this, you're going to go with the ease and the things that make you more comfortable. I was forced to confess the insufficiency of my knowledge, begged you for instruction. This is the secular Jew speaking to Rav Hirsch's imaginal character. When the coachman called, and in bidding me goodbye, you had only the time to call in writing. You have, therefore, made me distrustful, my dear Naftali, of the opinions I have hitherto held, but you have not refuted them, nor given me better ones in their stead. Meaning, you basically convinced me that my opinions and my view on life is unfounded, but you haven't told me what can I do instead. I therefore take advantage of your kind permission and repeat to you in writing a number of my charges, not for the purpose of defending my present mode of life, but in the sincere desire of information and guidance. Every religion, I believe, should bring man nearer to his ultimate end. This end, what else can it be than the attainment of happiness and perfection? So that last line is not without problem, obviously. Rav Hirsch is going to respond to it. By the way, I forgot to mention something I really liked about Dr. Abramson's presentation of Rav Hirsch's life. When he's writing this, so he's living in Oldenburg, which we said was a very small town, and he had no rabbinic friends, and he actually wrote to his father, the merchant, but also assistant rabbi. He wrote to his father, you know, Dad, it's very lonely over here. I've got no other rabbinic colleagues to talk to. I sort of felt what he was going through from Kansas City, but I did have some people to talk to, but not the people that I would, whatever. So his father writes back to him. He says, the Mishnah says, "Kanei lecha chaver," right? Acquire for your friend, for yourself a friend. So another word with kuf nun hey is kane. A kane is a pen. So he says, "Kane lecha chaver." Write to people.
Yeah.
Use your pen. Your pen will be your friend. Right? You don't have people around you, so pick up the phone and call somebody. Not that back then, but you know, that's the modern day equivalent. You know, you don't have to be so lonely. Email, yeah. Text them, yeah. So this is the response from this Naftali ben Uziel. The beginning of the response. The next 18 letters are a response. You estimate the value of Judaism by the principle of the purpose of human existence, and this, in your view, is found in happiness and perfection. I could ask, is it so sure that happiness and perfection form the goal and object of man's being? Right? You clearly assumed that that's the point of life. I could ask upon what basis you found this opinion, or what could you answer to the careless pleasure seeker or criminal who thinks the excitement and sensual lust of the moment a greater happiness than all temporal or eternal blessings. Basically, he's saying, is happiness really the end-all, be-all? a criminal feels happiness, does that mean you should be a criminal? He said, I could ask that question. That's where it first starts. I could ask that question.
That's the default worldly view.
Maybe. Everyone must be permitted to be his own judge of what constitutes happiness for him. For happiness decreed in accordance with any compulsory external standard ceases to be happiness. Right? If you force somebody to do something, so it's not happy anymore. And the perfecting of one's being, the mounting of the highest intellectual heights, by how few ever attained, by how few attainable. He's basically saying that's a terrible threshold. And he says, but I'm not, and then he goes, I'm not even going to ask that though. We're not even going to talk about that. Because that doesn't make any sense. Rather, truth itself is conceived by 1,000 thinkers in 1,000 different ways. To neglect its pursuit is, after all, only a sin against oneself. And therefore, one can only be accountable to oneself. For to whom would I owe an accounting if this principle only demands a promotion of the happiness and perfection of others as a means of attaining my own and I relinquish this? Meaning, if the only thing that I base my life on is happiness, so then what about truth? Right? What about trying to find the actual reality that we live in? How, I would ask you, is it with the multitude of unhappy and imperfect ones outside of Judaism? Right? So you're telling me your assumption is that I have to be non-Jewish in order to fulfill this happiness. Well, there are plenty of people that aren't Jewish that also aren't happy. So that clearly can't be the barometer. But I will omit all these questions. Let us put aside for a while the standard of measurement. And let us try to know that which we desire to measure, Judaism. Right? We're talking about Judaism. Let's look at Judaism. In its history and its teachings. Perhaps on the way we may learn to think differently concerning the destiny of mankind and may obtain a different mode of discerning the purpose of the existence of the nations and their duties. But we must become acquainted with it from the source with which it itself points out to us, which it has rescued from the wreck of all its other fortunes as the only original document and source of instruction concerning its true essence from its Torah. Says Rav Hirsch, if you want to know Judaism, you have to study it. You can't just look at all the people putting on tefillin. You can't just look at all the people lighting Shabbos candles and think you know Judaism. If you want to know Judaism, you got to look at the source. And that's the Torah. And the next 18 letters are basically a study of sources and a study of the text in order to show this person, you really don't know what Judaism is all about. Let's learn what Judaism is all about from Judaism and not from anything else. So that's Rav Hirsch's response, at least the beginning of his response to this imaginal character. But it's in many ways indicative of where Rav Hirsch was coming from in his whole life, trying to convince people, as Rav Shlomo Carlbach said, that everybody... Judaism has what to offer for everybody. You know, it's just that nobody wants to look at the menu. Everyone thinks they know about Judaism, but no one's actually looking at it. So that's where Rav Hirsch's point is. If we just look and we dig the text, we delve into what it means, so then we'll be able to actually understand it. Everybody who has, gone into the secular route is basically assuming they know what Judaism is, and therefore assuming that they know better. Or that this is better, or that that's better. But instead, Rav Hirsch's whole point, and you can see it through all his writing, his Chorev, and you can see it in his commentary of the Torah, we have to delve into the text. And when we do that, you'll find it's very meaningful, and it speaks to every generation, not just the antiquated ones, and not just the ones that had different social societal norms, but every generation has something meaningful to find in the Torah. And that's what he means, Torah Derech Eretz, that it's our embrace of society, which can also be spoken to by the Torah. It's not just two separate things that we have to dismiss one or the other, but that actually, they can work in tandem. So that's the legacy of Rav Hirsch. How exactly that transfers over to American society is a different question, but it's certainly the bedrock of Rav Hirsch's philosophy to engage with both and find a way to embrace each of them in their own way so that they're not mutually exclusive. And as we said before, when push comes to shove, we know which one has to be prioritized and which one has to be put aside. But that's for a different time. That's Rav Shamshon Frohl Hirsch. Tomorrow is the actual date of his death in the English calendar, but his yahrzeit is the 27th of Tevet. Thank you for coming. Mirza Shem on Wednesday. We will hear a little bit more about him and his relationship with Rabbi Bernard Eloi and how that affected some of Rabbi Bernard Eloi's actual behavior in America. Trying to do what Rav Hirsch did, but on a much greater challenge with the non-religious Jews that he found here. Okay, everyone should be well.